We thank you so much for coming to our session. We're going to be talking to you today about collaboration, and this is based off of some of our own experiences with collaboration, both good and bad, but we're going to focus on mostly the good and what we've seen done by others and what we've done ourselves that has really proven to make collaboration a lot less stressful and a lot more advantageous for all parties. So hopefully you will get some good information from that. So who are we? My name is Tracy Hodges, and I am about to be a graduate from Texas A&M. I graduate in August with my PhD, and then, yeah, I'm so excited. Thank you. The one clapping thing really confused me in there, so I'm not good at that. But I'm about to start my career as an assistant professor in the fall, which I'm also equally excited about. And the reason that I got through grad school and the reason that I was able to get publications and presentations in grad school was because of the topic we're going to talk to you about today, collaboration. It's really hard to get all of those manuscripts out that you have to get out if you're doing it by yourself and in isolation. It's even harder if you don't have collaborators that you trust or good collaborators. And I've definitely been in situations where the collaborations ended in tears and been in situations where the collaborations just did not go any further. And then been in collaborations predominantly with this lady to my right that have been very successful and that have given us even more publications and presentations. And so that's what we hope that you will be able to get out of this as well.
And I'm Catherine Wright. I am entering my fourth year of the doc program, so I'm 1 year behind Tracy, so I'm not yet, still excited, but not quite as close to being done. And I kind of joke that what I've done in grad school is I just found Tracy and Chilis too, who's in the back corner. You don't get out of this. And basically followed their lead. So they did one thing, and I just said, oh, well, it's working for them, so I better do that too. So my first year in the program, Tracy approached me and said, hey, we should work on a project together. And so me being me, okay, yes, that's a good idea. And that's how I started this. And even between the two of us, we've had some projects that have gone swimmingly and some projects that have gone less than swimmingly. However, we learned from this, and being analytical, the two of us kind of want to sit down and say, all right, well, what made the good collaborations good and what made the bad ones bad? Because I know sometimes when we have to work with people, things go so astray and you can point one finger and say, okay, it was this, and that's easy. Then you just don't work with that person again and you can move on. But I think there's a lot more shades of gray when things go wrong and when things go well. So we were trying to figure out and put our finger on what made these things go well. And so that's what we're going to talk to you guys about today.
And one of the collaborations that we've had recently is both of us have had to write dissertations. Catherine's still in the process of writing hers, and I just finished mine. We both put together research teams that consisted of fellow graduate students, faculty members, both clinical and tenure track, and at various levels, assistant and associate and full. And we had undergrads who worked with us as well, who were part of our collaborations and our teams. And so this idea of collaboration goes across every level within higher ed and with all different professors, and even can go cross-disciplinary as well. Okay, so we're going to begin by talking about what makes a team. Because when you're collaborating with other people, whether it's one person, two people, three people, you are a team, and you are working as a team together for a common goal. So what makes a team?
All right. One way to think about a team is that you're going to have different people serving different roles, and we all have different strengths. This first model we actually got from Dr. Dominique Klepp, who presented it to Tracy and I at one point, and it really resonated with us, so we ran with it. The idea is that on every team, be it a research team or all the way up to a major company, you need three types of people. You need a visionary or multiple visionaries, and this is the person with the big idea. They're the person that's the dreamer and comes up with these really grand ideas that gets everyone excited. Okay. Then you have the opportunist, who kind of has this idea about, all right, we've got this brilliant idea. How do we make it reality? Or what would that look like if it was reality? And then you also have to have an executioner, which sounds pretty negative, but it really isn't. I'm a self-identified executioner. All right. Now everyone's going to go running from the room. But no, seriously, stay. The executioner is the person who's really good at the details, who can think the day by day and the little steps about how are we going to make this happen. All right. In any group or organization, you need all three levels, and we all have a strength, right? That doesn't mean you are stuck in your bubble. As a graduate student doing my dissertation, I had to be a visionary for a little while. I had to come up with an idea, and I had to figure out what that was going to look like. But it's not my strength. It's not my comfortable spot, but I can do it. I want to give you a little example of this that I came up with. Can you click? Okay. So I was trying to think of a kind of a hypothetical example, try to illustrate this a little bit more concretely. I taught middle school. I like things to be concrete and clear. All right. So let's talk about the programs that give free breakfast to school children. Now, my undergrad degree is in history, so I do know that this actually came out of the 1960s, part of Great Society, somewhat attributed to the Black Panther Party. But we're going to just go hypothetically talking about this program in general. So in this program, you would, if you wanted to start serving breakfast to kids, you first need a visionary. And the visionary is going to be the person that says, hey, if kids are hungry, they're not learning. We need to serve them breakfast. They've got a great idea. Okay? And then you need an opportunist who's going to start to think about, how can we make this happen? So maybe what we need to do is connect with grocery stores and food pantries and things like that and get donations so that we can start serving breakfast. And then you need the executioner, and that's the person who's going to organize. Okay, we need volunteers outside in the morning. We're going to need the tables and the tablecloths, and we're going to need this many plates and those kind of details to make it actually happen. Now, I know as a self-identified executioner, I have worked with people who are visionaries, who are brilliant, but if your idea stays up in the clouds, it doesn't go anywhere. All right. So there's nothing wrong with being in this last spot. And I think it's actually kind of funny. When this was first presented to Tracy and I, Dr. Klepp was asking us, where do we think we identify? And Tracy looked at me and said, I don't want to insult you, but you're an executioner. And I said, oh, no, I'm not insulted. I know that. Like, this is something I'm very good at.
And equally at the same time, Catherine looked at me and she goes, well, right back at you, you're the visionary. And I said, oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I am.
Luckily, we can both kind of work in the middle when we need to and be opportunists and try to figure out how to connect. But you've got to have all three layers. Can you click?
Opportunists have a negative connotation.
Yeah, the word opportunist, yes, what he was just saying is that the word opportunist has a negative connotation, just like the word executioner has a negative connotation. However, and that's, I think, why it's important to realize, not everyone has to be the visionary all the time. That's, I think, of the three words, that's got the most positive connotation. So if you were just picking words out of a hat, well, of course I'd want to describe myself with the most positive sounding word. But you really need all three layers. So we want everyone to think for a second and realize that you do not need to put yourself in a bubble. And one bubble, this is not a box where you're stuck. But everyone's got a place where they feel the strongest, where they feel most comfortable. All right. I really like nitty-gritty details. It makes me happy to put things in order. I was sat in a presentation yesterday where the presenter was talking about checklists and all of this, and I just get all warm and fuzzy. All right. That's a great place to be. So that's where I want to work, but that doesn't mean I can't do the other roles.
Okay, does anyone think they know which of the three they would fall into, and would anyone like to share? Visionary, opportunist, and executioner.
Yeah, I think I'm a visionary type of person.
Yeah.
Usually I have those big ideas, but never ended to be a project.
Then what?
They never became a project.
Okay. So this is a very common problem. I don't want to say a problem, but the visionary is going to have these great ideas, but without a little help or pushing, sometimes it stays an idea and doesn't move forward. Thank you. Anyone else?
Yes, I agree that I think I am the visionary because you guys said that this is the person that gets everyone excited about it. But I do like the team that can help me put that into action.
Yeah.
Just like me, I know that I myself am not really very into details. I would prefer somebody else be into details. So I like to come up with the big idea and then be like, all right, Catherine, now what do we do? How do we do it? And let her make the checklist for us.
And I love the checklist. So kind of running on this idea, we've also set up our presentation into three little sections. One being the visionary, which is what we're talking about now, which is the big idea, the grand sweeping thing. What does a team look like? Then we have the opportunists, where we start to get into the details of how you make this team a reality. And then we have the executioner section, where we're going to talk about some nitty-gritty details about how you can really implement these strategies.
Okay, so before you even get started on the project, you really have to know your team. You have to know the people that you're working with and the people that you're going to be sharing in this adventure of the project with. Part of that is knowing yourself, if you're a visionary or an opportunist or executioner, but also knowing everybody else on your team. Where do they fall and in this particular project? So if there's someone who's a visionary that can sometimes be an opportunist, what is their role on your team? Where are they going to fit? The other part of that is understanding that we all have very different habits and work habits and tendencies. Knowing that about your teammates is going to make your life a whole lot easier. Because I know we've all been in situations where maybe you're someone who likes to get things done a week or two ahead of time, and you put somebody on your team who does things the morning it's due. Is that going to drive you crazy? And the person who does it the morning of, they're going to sit there looking at you going, what are you doing? Why are you done? We have a week and a half. I've worked with these people too. And I used to be the person who did it the morning of, so I understand how frustrating that can be on both sides. So it's important to understand those habits of everyone to kind of have a little bit more compassion and understanding before you even start your team. So this information is coming from Better Than Before by Gretchen Rubin. It's one of her new books on habits. It talks all about habits, understanding your own personal habits, and understanding the habits of others. She even goes so far as to talk about whether you're an owl or a lark. Are you a nighttime person or a morning person? Are you a person who makes checklists? Are you a person who does big goals or small goals? Learning all of these things about yourself. So she separates people into four different groups based on your habit tendencies. Okay, now there's two types of expectations that we all face in our lives. The first are external expectations. So following all of the rules of your university, turning in paperwork when it's due, answering emails that other people have sent to you, feeding your children so they don't starve. External expectations, things you have to do for other people. Then there's internal expectations. These are the things you do for yourself. I'm going to walk every morning in that. Walk for an hour every morning because it makes me feel good and it's for my health. I'm going to eat healthier, more salads during the day and less burgers. I am going to read for 30 minutes every night before bed. So the things we do for ourselves that are self-imposed are internal. Okay? So first you have the upholders. These people complete every single task that they are given. If it's an external expectation, they do it. They follow every rule. If it's an internal expectation, they do it. Everything. So these are the people who say, I'm going to work out every morning and then go to work. They work out every morning, and they go to work, and they follow all the rules. They do the paperwork the second that they get it. They follow all the traffic laws. Don't speed. Okay? Upholders.
And if you're an upholder, as I am very much so, it can be exhausting, because you're trying to please everyone and yourself. And it also can be very difficult sometimes when you're working with other people because I do what I'm supposed to because it's just, I don't know, because I'm an upholder. That's why I do it. And so when people don't always do everything that way, it took me a while to realize that, like, I was like, well, what's wrong? How do you not see how important this is? But that's because that's my worldview. And I'm actually trying to work to branch out of this bubble a little bit because it is exhausting.
You can change your habits.
Change some habits, exactly.
Now, a very small portion of the population are actually upholders, but a large percentage of professors, I would guess, are upholders and academics. So keep that in mind. The second group are the questioners. This is my personal favorite group because that's me. Questioners will do everything that they see value in. So internal expectations, they're pretty much going to do all of it because they think there's value in reading 30 minutes before bed. They think there's value in walking for their health. External expectations, not so much. They won't turn in that paperwork like they're supposed to if they don't really feel like doing the paperwork or think it's important to their agenda. They won't necessarily follow, like, you know, speed limits if they don't think the speed limits are that important. They're all laughing because That's me. And they question every single thing, hence the name questioner. So when you ask them to do something, you know, Tracy, I need you to fill out this paper and turn it in by the end of the day. Why? What is this paper for? What is this information for? Why do you need this information? They ask lots and lots of questions. When I was in school, I remember my high school geometry teacher, still to this day, he would go through the lesson and I would raise my hand because I had a question. He'd go, no, you have to wait. And he would answer everyone else's questions. And he'd be like, okay, because one question would lead to five questions, would lead to 10 questions. Okay, these are the questioners. So every single internal expectation important to them, external, they have to trust you. Okay, they have to want to do it for you or see the value in it. Do I have any other questioners in here? The majority of the population is either a questioner or an obliger, because they're kind of the two in the middle.
Sometimes we call the questioner is the avoider, because he wants to talk himself out of doing anything. So call them the avoiders.
It could be used, so he's saying you could like question yourself out of doing something. It could be that too. Who knows why we do it? We need information. Very analytical. Okay, the obligers. Now, interestingly enough, according to Gretchen Rubin in her book, she says obligers are the group that doesn't want to admit they're obligers because it has like kind of negative connotations, which you were saying earlier, but embrace it. So obligers, they will do every single external obligation. I'm going to feed the kids. I'm going to take the kids to soccer practice. I'm going to wash the dishes. I am going to do all the paperwork my faculty or my department asked me to do. I'm going to finish every task that I'm given on the project, even if I have to stay up late doing it because somebody else asked me to do it. I'm going to get it done. The internal stuff, not so much. That's what falls by the wayside a little bit. So these people do so much for other people that sometimes they're the ones who forget about themselves and forget to take care of themselves. Some of you are smiling. You're like, yep, I'm a giver. I am a giver. I admit it. Okay? Those people, they're you know, wonderful, wonderful people. They do everything for everyone else, but they kind of take advantage of themselves a little bit. So those are the obligers. And then the last group, the rebels. Again, a very small percentage of the population are rebels. Rebels really avoid the whole thing of habits. They don't like habits. They like doing what they want to do every day, all day. So internal or external, it's more of a question of wake up in the morning. What do I want to do today? Every day looks different, and they kind of just, they don't follow habits. And if you try to impose something on them, you try to say, okay, you're a rebel. I need you to get this done by Friday. They're going to go, I want to do it a lot less now that you told me I had to. And again, I see heads nodding and laughing and smirking. There are some rebels in here. I can feel it. Well, I saw Chillis doing it, so who knows? Okay, so then you have the rebels. Now, the important thing to know about all four of these groups is you're going to have a mixture of these people on your team. So it's important to know if you're an upholder and you're working with people and they don't get something done, think about why. Okay, are they a rebel and you enforced some deadline that was ridiculous and it made them not do it? Are they an obliger and they did get it done? Are they a questioner and you didn't answer their question and tell them why this was valuable to the project? So that's very important to kind of consider when you're working with these people. So again, we want you to take a minute and kind of think about who you are and if you feel comfortable sharing, who do you think you are? Yeah?
And the thing to remember too is that you can work with your group members and use their strengths. So for example, when Tracy and I need some paperwork signed for something, and I know we're going to have to push somebody, I send her. Because if I go to, you know, our department head and say, we need this signed, and he says no, I go, okay. Whereas Tracy's going to go in and say, well, but why not? And very polite, she's not rude. But whereas I'll kind of back down, because, well, he said no, okay, that's fine. So I use this to my advantage. And at the same time, I know there have been times that we'll be sitting in a meeting and Tracy needs something done, and she knows if she says it out loud and says that that it needs to be accomplished, eventually I'm going to jump on and I'll do it. So you can use your knowledge of your group members and use those strengths to really help you out.
Yes, so it could also work in marriage. Know your partner. Okay, so continuing on, you know who your team members are now. You know the visionaries and the opportunists and the executioners. You know the habits of each of your group members. You know how they work and what's important to them. That is very important, those values. So what's a professional team? A professional team, number one, has a shared goal or objective, something that they are trying to accomplish, and it is shared. Sometimes we take that for granted with collaborations, that we all aren't on the same page. You need to make sure you and your team are all on the same page and we're all working towards that same goal. Because if I have one goal and Catherine has a different goal, bad things are probably going to happen somewhere down the line. It's also going to get real tricky when you start to write. What's your argument if you have two separate goals? You had two separate outcomes that you were expecting. Second, it's a professional networking opportunity. It's a way to network with your colleagues that are close to you and far away from you. We have Skype, we have FaceTime, we have Google Chats and Hangouts, and you can connect with people who are very, very far away very easily. This past year, my major chair has been on sabbatical in Norway, and it has felt like she was gone quite often. I've missed her. But I got to Skype with her, and I got to chat with her on email, and at least weekly, if not when I was writing my dissertation, more than once a day. And it didn't feel that bad, except for, you know, 8-hour difference and stuff like that. You have to have a basic understanding of each of your teammates' strengths, which is what Catherine was really saying about understanding that, you know, if I'm a questioner, you got to convince me that what we're doing is important and I have value for it. Or you have to make me feel like I have value. Catherine's really good about that. She's like, you know, Tracy, you did such a good job putting this presentation together. That is so good. And I'm like, no, value. I am valued. I want to work with you again. It can even be that small. And then the last thing is that they're built through honesty, communication, and support. So make sure that with your teammates, you're honest. There's a lot of honesty that goes into understanding habits and understanding everybody's shared vision. You also have to make sure you communicate. You don't go for weeks on end without talking to your teammates, or else they're going to forget about the project. And they have to feel supported. So if you're working on a team and somebody feels like their words aren't really being, you know, valued, or they are trying to do a task and they don't know what they're doing, then you have to give them support. And again, I'm going to share something that Catherine did in one of our teams. We were working with two undergraduate students, one undergraduate student who's probably going to be president someday. She's, you know, gung-ho, that undergrad that you see and you're like, oh, you're going to take over the world. Go do it. And then one who is brilliant, but she's a lot more quiet and a lot more reserved and more of the, I just want to be the wind. I want to push and be forceful, but I don't want the attention. And we've been working on putting together a rubric and scoring things. And every time we would score things, the shyer undergrad, her scores would be off from the other three of us. Consistent every time. But we were scoring student work, and Catherine, myself, and the other undergrad would be a little more harsh in our scoring, maybe a little more realistic, and the other undergrad would be much nicer. She wants to teach very small children and work in occupational therapy. She's going to do a great job at it, and she's going to be wonderful. But when she would get upset when we were doing the rubrics, I don't want to do the rubrics again today. I really don't like the rubric because her scores were always different from ours. And Catherine would say, you know what? Your scores are consistent every time. That means that you are doing what you're supposed to. You just have a different take on what good writing is, and you're going to be nurturing and supportive when you're a teacher. And that student would work on the rubric every time we pulled it out, even though she didn't like it, and did it wonderfully because of that support she had from her team leader. So it's really important to make sure that your team members feel valued no matter where they are.
So we wanted to talk about this idea of building a team, not team building. The one place where I tend to not be an upholder is icebreaker type activities or any of those like group, like get to know each other things. I'll do it. I do end up doing it, but I roll my eyes a little bit. And we've all been those kind of four situations. The thing about team building activities is that you've already thrown a bunch of people together, and now you've got to try to make it work. All right. So we're not talking about that. We're talking about building a team where you're going to select the people very, very purposefully so that you don't have to do team building activities because the team is going to work. All right. I really think about, Tracy and I went back and forth for a while on like what metaphor do we want to use, and we got really complicated. But I think it's really, you got to go simple sometimes, and that's the best way to go about it. If you have a machine, any machine, a computer, a car, you know, I don't care what. If there's a piece missing, you can't just go get some random piece of that machine and stick it in there and hope for the best. You have to get the right piece and the correct piece. So in the same way, if something's missing from your team, you can't just go get another body. You can't get, you know, pulse is not enough. You need someone who can serve whatever purpose you need, whatever is missing from your team. All right. And you need to make sure everyone knows what their role is, what piece they are, how they're filling that in. And I really learned this from Tracy. When Tracy asked me to help her out on her dissertation team, she pulled me aside and said, Catherine, we need to do a lot of observations, and I need help, and this is how I think you can help. This is what I think you're bringing to the group. And I automatically felt valued, and I knew that I had a role. So I was more motivated to help out because I had a place. It wasn't just, oh, you know, we're friends, and you don't make me too annoyed, so why don't you just come hang out with me? You know, I felt like I felt I had a special skill that I was bringing forward. Another thing, too, is it makes it really easy to divide tasks. If everyone comes in knowing explicitly what their job is, when there's something that needs to be done, it's going to be kind of clear who that goes to. Now, that doesn't mean other people can't jump in, or someone might say, you know, I've got extra time this week, I want to do that. But then you don't have that kind of silence when the crickets chirping when you say, okay, guys, this week we need to really clean up the data, and everyone's just staring at the wall. That's clear, you know, it clearly falls to somebody, and that person's going to be more motivated to take it on if they feel like there's a reason why they're taking it on. That's their job. That's their role. That's the strength they're bringing. And like I said, it really increases motivation. We both have done a lot of work looking at reading motivation specifically with students and how can you get kids to participate in this activity in class. And they need to see the value. They need to see the importance. And they need to know that it's not arbitrary. It's the kind of same thing with a team. When you know that your involvement is not arbitrary, when you know that you are bringing a very specific skill set to the group, you feel motivated to contribute.
Okay, in addition to what Catherine said about dividing the roles, when I did my dissertation research and I asked Catherine to be on the team, I said what she said I said to her. But for the other team members, I pulled people aside and I said, you know, Jen, you have an expertise in preparing future teachers. I really need your perspective on preparing future teachers to work on building this instrument. And then I would go to the next person and say, you know what, your expertise is in writing. I really need help creating a rubric. That's what I want you to help me with. And so when we would have meetings, those people would share ideas specific to that role that I had given them, and they can break out from it too. But you had a perspective you were bringing that was unique from the other five people on the team right off the bat, which is really great. One of the most important things you have to do on a team is communication. Like we said, I've been on teams before where I've started working on a project and they've said, do this task. And then we didn't meet for 3 or 4 weeks. Do you know what happened to the task? It didn't get done. Yeah, y'all are all like, I know what happened to the task. I've done this too. But as soon as someone said, okay, we're going to meet tomorrow. Can you bring your part of it? Well, okay. I'm going to get the task done because we're going to meet. And there's some kind of a communication and accountability to that. But it needs to be consistent and it needs to be effective. It ensures that everyone knows what's going on at all times. Projects often are, you know, they develop. They're organisms that are growing. And so we need to make sure that we know that everyone's on the same page at all times, even as the project is changing. It also helps make sure that everyone still understands what their role is. If they finish their role on the team, you've made it clear, like, are they still on the team? Well, yes. Well, now what am I doing? If I've already helped you develop the rubric that you needed, what's my next task? You keep them informed of that. And then the last thing is that people don't feel alone. One of the themes of this conference so far has been that writing is sometimes something we do in isolation, and we can feel very alone when we do it. And you can feel that way on a team if nobody's helping you. But if you have the constant communication and support from your team, then you're not going to feel alone. And you're going to constantly feel like you can get help. So when you give someone a task and they go, I don't really know how to do that task, they feel like they can come to you and then the task gets done. Rather than what happens sometimes with, I'm not checking up on you, I'm not checking up on you, oh no, the task fell. So some strategies that we did, both of us, for our dissertations, and we've seen this from other people, for having effective communication. The first is to have regularly scheduled meetings, okay? And this can be as frequent as you need it to be. It can be a weekly meeting, it can be a monthly meeting, every 2 weeks, whatever your team needs. So when my team was developing all the instruments for my study, we met every single week at the same time in the same room. People knew what was coming, okay? It can be when we were doing data collection and we were all out and it was crazy, we met like once every 3 weeks because it was just a different point in the project, but it was still regular. And it builds the importance of the project and lets everyone know you're still thinking about it. The other thing that I did was a weekly project synthesis. I love weekly synthesis, let me just tell you. So we would meet usually on Mondays. And usually on Sunday night, I would send out a weekly report almost to my whole team. And it was just a quick little email that said, here are the things we got done this week. Here are the things that we're planning to do in the next couple of weeks. And here's how we are on track for our timeline for the project. And that way people always knew what was going on. And if you mention people in the weekly synthesis, you know, Catherine finished the rubric for this week and it was great. Then they also get that little like gold star of recognition that can really make people feel great and want to keep working on your team. That little bit of motivation and knowing that they're important to your team.
Can I ask you a question about that? So far, it's very clear the value added for you. What is not clear to me is what were you adding to your team members? Like, what do I get out of making you a rubric? I don't get an author credit on your dissertation. I develop instruments for you. I don't get any author credit. So can you talk a little bit about the other side, what you were contributing to the team?
Absolutely. So what my contribution then to everybody else was, no, you didn't get recognition. Well, you got recognized in my acknowledgments on my dissertation. But now that the dissertation is being published, you are on those publications. And we'll talk a little bit about authorship towards the end. But you are on those publications. We've done, from my dissertation, I think, like I would gander like 7 or 8 presentations at this point at the national level, and you've been on those presentations if you were working on my team. I also got grants and paid people to do some of the work.
So all of those conversations happened beforehand. I think that's a really important piece that we need to hear.
Yeah, and as someone who was drawn on to Trace's dissertation, she pulled me on and said, okay, Catherine, I need help with observations. I've got funding to pay you this much for every observation. Do you want to do this? And we'll talk about authorship in just a little bit later, but I agree. And part of being this, having this open communication is having that stuff up front right away and telling them, well, if we, you know, honestly, and everyone knows, okay, you can't have co-authors on your dissertation, otherwise we'd all get done a lot faster. But saying where are the benefits going to be and where is that going to happen and making that really clear and upfront so that way there's no surprises later. And because you don't know what other people are anticipating and expecting, and that can lead, you know, the idea is that you're building long-term collaborative partnerships. So Tracy's a year ahead of me, so when I started my dissertation process, she included me on hers, I got to help out, and I got a lot of, my CV is full of the last name Hodges. All right, so when I started building mine, the obvious next step was to talk to Tracy about helping me out and how can she help and join the team and add to the team. Jen, did you ever?
And I apologize, that you may have answered this in the first 5 minutes, which I missed, and if so, I apologize. This seems to be more of like building a larger team with one team leader. Is there such thing as a partnership or a smaller team without an obvious a leader as that? Could you?
I do think it applies. Yes, I do think a lot of this applies to when you're just doing partnerships too. But I do think that it's important that there is one person who is kind of taking a leadership role even in partnerships, in that there's somebody who's kind of keeping things moving. And that's really one of the ways that we work really well together and with different collaborations is we say, okay, this is your thing. So you're in charge of this and I'm going to help, but you're the one who's kind of leading the charge. And we found that having that person really helps, because when there is no clear kind of leader, even in a partnership, sometimes you can be like, well, I thought you were going to do that. No, I thought you were going to do that. And that sometimes happens. But I think it works even in small groups.
So, for example, Tracy and I are working on a meta-analysis together. We've been on it now. The group who we work with has heard about this darn thing now for 2 years. So it's been a very long, ongoing process. But we decided pretty early on that I was going to be first author. And recently we were sitting down and trying to decide whether or not to include a couple articles. And we disagreed. But in this case, I'm first. I'm technically in charge, even though I always defer and like ask Tracy for her judgment. But when it push comes to shove, include or exclude, it's coming down to my decision. And that makes it so much easier. Otherwise, I mean, we're both intelligent, opinionated people. We will sit there for weeks, and then it'll become the kind of conversation that we're just having, you know, I won't care anymore. I'll just want to be right. And I think that's kind of human nature. But we've established Tracy made her point. I explained my points. We made the decision, and then we move forward. So I do think it's really important to kind of decide who, at the end of the day, is going to kind of be the one responsible.
We also think it's important to have some due dates, like whenever you assign tasks to have a due date. As one of the presenters had said yesterday, you are the master of your universe, and even in teams, you are the masters of your universe. And so you can change the due dates if you need to, but you need to have due dates in place or else, again, things don't get done. If you say to your team, we need a lit review, and that's what you say, we need a lit review. Well, when is the lit review going to get done? When do we need to have progress on it? But if we say a specific time, the lit review needs to be done in 3 months, that gives us something a little bit easier to work with, and then you can break it down even further from there. And then the last thing is scheduling actual time to work with your group so that meetings aren't always just delegating tasks and handing out tasks, but there's time to talk about the project, talk about different articles you want to include, talk about different pieces of writing people have done to give feedback and support. So that way, again, people have time to work, they have time to get support, and there's constant feedback going from every group member to every other group member if necessary. So how then do you delegate the work if you have this big project? The first thing that I usually do is try to come up with a timeline for the project. So I think as a team, you can do this in collaboration with your whole group, or you can do this just with the one person who you've decided is going to be the person in charge. But come up with a timeline, how long you want this project to last, and it should be goals. I like to do this by month. You could do this by week, by 2 months, by semester, whatever works for you. So for my dissertation research, this was the timeline that I had created. And you see how, you know, technical it is. It was on a Word doc. I've seen people do this in Excel and in lots of different modes, so whatever works for you. But I just did every month from September of 2013 until I was going to finally defend, and which was February of 2015, and went through and said, here are the goals of what we want to get done each month of the project. This tells your group members what you're going to be working on at each point, and they can see the progression. And again, this timeline, you can see those words underneath it. It's tentative and subject to change, but this gives us a starting point and something to shoot for. I usually like to go on the side of, I think it's going to take us 3 weeks to do this, so I'm going to assume it's going to take us a month and a half. Because if we finish early, people are usually really excited and happy, but if you finish late, people are usually frustrated and grumpy.
I think it's also important to note that anyone who's been a classroom teacher, the objectives are all measurable and concrete. It's not work on lit review. What are we going to accomplish on the lit review? Because work on lit review for me can mean something completely different than everyone else in this room. So if you would just say work on lit review, that's not communicating with your team. You got to be very concrete and specific about what you're going to do, something that can be measured, something you can put a check mark next to and everyone will agree, yes, this has been accomplished.
Okay, so once you have your timeline, then you have your big goals for what you want to accomplish. The next step is to break that into smaller pieces, okay? So if my goal was to develop a rubric to score writing, what tasks do we have to do in order to meet that goal? So some of the tasks might be we need to find some sample rubrics, we need to gather research, we need to gather information on Likert scales and what's a good Likert scale, and we probably need to review some student samples of what we're actually going to measure to see what comes out, what might be important. These tasks become the things that you can then delegate. Because if I told someone, I need you to make a rubric, that's kind of hard. What kind of rubric? I have lots of questions for you and questions you might not be able to answer. But if we break it down and do these smaller tasks first, then we can put all that together, and before you know it, we have a rubric.
And this is where knowing if you've got a visionary, an opportunist, or an executioner in your group really helps. If you've got an executioner in your group who wants to make this little list, please give it to me. Okay, I want to make the task list. I like thinking about that. All right, so know who's in your group, and that this is something you can delegate out to someone else and really play on everyone's strengths.
And this comes from Megan McIntosh's work of breaking things down into those chunks, hunks, and bites. But that's what this is doing. The bites are those little things you can get done in an afternoon or in a day or in a session or two. And that's what you want to give people, because if you give them a task that's bigger than that, they're not going to be able to do it unless they are kind of sitting in your head and know it, or they're going to struggle a lot more with it. Megan McIntosh. Megan.com. So then these tasks, I always put them on a meeting agenda. So then when I go into the meeting, I have an agenda. I cannot stand to go into meetings that don't have agendas, because I'm like, why am I here? What am I doing? Why is my time being used for this?
And you've all been in that meeting.
That's right. I'm the questioner. That's what I do. And so I make an agenda, and it doesn't have to be fancy, and it can be fairly short, but I put on the agenda, here are the things we're going to discuss. Here are the people that need to present or share some of the work that they've done. And then at the bottom, I have a task list and say, these are the next tasks that we need to do. So we go into the meeting. I usually send the agenda out before the meeting so people can look at it. Again, I like getting agendas in advance because I'm a questioner and I want to know what I'm getting into. I don't like surprises. Surprise party for me would be devastating. Like, it's not cool. I would have so many questions for you. So you go into the meeting, you have your agenda, you get through all of your tasks, and then at the end you say, okay, here are the tasks for the next week. And then I let people choose what task they are. Remember, you assigned roles to people when you asked them to be part of their team. They're going to look at that and they're going to say, I was asked because I have knowledge of classroom observations. That task is classroom observations. I want to do it. About 90% of the time, people chose all the tasks they wanted to do, and there was no problem. 10% of the time, I had to give a task to someone. I had to say, well, would you be able to do that this week, this task? And because 90% of the time they got to choose, the 10% that you delegated it specifically, they went, oh, yeah, I can do that. No big deal.
And something else about having the agenda, and that Tracy was really good about, and I've tried to implement myself, I always felt like my time was being respected. That I was showing up at the meeting, we were going to get these things done, and Tracy watched the clock, which we're not doing a good job of today, but, you know, Tracy would watch the clock, and if we were meeting from 2 to 3, at 3 o'clock, we were out, and that's it. If we had to move stuff to the next week, that's fine. Occasionally, maybe we'd hang out for another 5 minutes or so, but that made me always feel like, okay, Tracy knows I have things going on besides this project. She's used the time as wisely as possible, and, okay, we're going to be done at 3 o'clock. We have all sat in those meetings where you get there and the person who's supposedly in charge is kind of like, all right, now we got to talk about this. And there's not really any direction. And then all of a sudden you're like, we've gone 30 minutes over and we're not done. No one likes that. No one likes to be in that meeting. No one likes to be the person running that meeting because, you know, they didn't think of how to organize it. So this has really helped prevent that.
And again, if you schedule an hour-long meeting but you only have stuff for 30 minutes, people are not upset when you let them out of a meeting early. Look at that. Okay? And sometimes there would be times when I would schedule like 15 things on the agenda thinking they're not going to take very long, and we would get through 5 of them. And again, at the end of the hour, you say, okay, guys, we didn't get through everything. Thank you all for coming. Thank you for what we did. And that stuff goes on next week, and it's okay. That's why the timeline is tentative.
All right, so we've talked about the big idea, what a team should look like. We've talked about, okay, how do we start making this reality? We're going to start getting into kind of the nitty-gritty, the very practical stuff about what can you do, what tools are out there to help you out. All right, I'm assuming most people here have experience with the Google Drive and Dropbox, correct? Okay. These are both free tools in the document sharing software. I'm not going to go into tons of detail because, again, I'm sure you guys have all used most of these. But I do want to kind of talk a little bit about the pros and cons and when you would use one over the other. We've used both in team projects to kind of keep everyone on board and on the same page, and they definitely have different strengths and weaknesses. One thing with Google Drive that drives me nuts is that everything's saved in a Google format. You can download it. And it says it's Microsoft, but just formatting gets messed up, all right? And we've all, you know, it happens. It's not perfect. Sometimes it's better than others. One thing I do like, though, is that you really can work at the same time from different computers. Technically, with Dropbox, you can both open the document and be working on it. But then you get this nifty little thing that'll pop up in your Dropbox where it'll say, like, you know, manuscript file, Catherine Wright's conflicted copy. All right. Now, if you're not paying attention to this and you're Catherine Wright, you just see Catherine Wright, and then you start opening it and keep working on that document, whereas Tracy's back on the original one, and suddenly we have two documents going, which is not helpful. So times that I know we're under a crunch and we're both going to be working, or it's in, you know, even more when you have more people on the project, when we know there's a lot of people who are going to be working on the project within the same time frame, we'll use Google Drive because we can both open it and see the changes being made without worrying about the conflicted copies issue. You're not going to end up with two documents. I do like with Google Drive that there's an integrated chat feature. You can leave the comments, and so there's been times that I'll be working on something, I'll think of something, and I'll leave Tracy a comment kind of saying, like, hey, this reminds me of that thing you said last week. Maybe you want to integrate that here as well. And you can do that again on Dropbox if you just use Microsoft Word's comment feature, but there's something kind of nice about the integration in Google Drive. I also like the Google Drive. You can see the changes other authors have made if you look at the revision history. So if you're looking at a document and you go, okay, something's different here, I can't quite remember what's been changed. With Dropbox, you can go back and find the previous versions, but it's a little bit of effort. Google Drive, you can just hit the revision history and see it pretty quickly. Some of the benefits of Dropbox are that everything stays in whatever format you put it in, and I like that. It doesn't get messed up. And multiple authors can work on the documents, but like I said, if you're opening the same document at the same time, you're going to have that conflicted copy issue. It does save the prior drafts, which can be retrieved, which is really useful because everyone's got access to it. Like, sometimes you hit delete and you don't mean to. Don't worry, it's not gone forever. It can be retrieved. And the fact that it now can sync with, I mean, I've got it on my phone, my iPad, my computer, and can access it from any computer anywhere is really helpful. So basically, we use Google Drive when we're having multiple authors, especially if you've got more than two people working on the same exact document within like the same time frame. And that way you can ensure that everyone is seeing what's going on in real time. If you have more time, and you know, so for example, I mentioned that Tracy and I have been working on a meta-analysis for a very long time now. I'm not really worried that we'll both happen to open it up at the same time. So we keep that in Dropbox. And sometimes we'll just have separate documents, like, oh, I'm working on the lit review, and that just says meta-analysis lit review. And we keep all that in Dropbox. But when you need to have more than one person with a document open, especially, let's say, you're working from a distance, so Tracy's now going to leave A&M, and we're going to have to communicate via all this technology and stuff, we might use Google Drive a little bit more because then we can both open up a document and work on it while we're talking to each other.
Okay, so then how do you break down the writing task? Because once you've done data collection and everything else, it can be really difficult to break down those writing tasks. And I often hear from different people say, I don't know what I'm going to have you write, but I want you to write something. I'm like, well, how are you going to break it down? And they go, oh, I don't really know. One of the ways you can start is with the matrix methods by Judith Girard, and we learned about it in Power. But the matrix is a way to synthesize research. And again, you can create a Excel file with a matrix and put it into Excel, and put it in Google Drive and then have your whole team working on it at the same time. I don't care if the formatting of a matrix is correct. No one's going to see it but our team. I care about the data and the information that's in there. And so you can give each of your teammates 5 articles to read and put in the matrix. And you have one row is one article, and then you have different columns of things they're going to look for. So I need a definition for motivation. I need to know what kind of instruments they used. I need a brief synopsis of the results. I need the research questions. You decide, and then people just read through, basically encode the articles as they're reading and put the information in. If you have 5 people and they each read 5 articles, that's 25 articles. That's awesome. And then when you want to write up your results, you look through their results when you're writing the lit review, and you're like, huh, look, we have some themes here coming out. Okay, and it can make that a lot simpler. If you are doing a systematic lit review or a meta-analysis, you can break up the coding in this way. This is how we did our meta-analysis, and we just all coded in Google Docs in a matrix. And that way we're all looking for the exact same information, and we have the same eye as we're reading. And all the information then is a little bit more consistent, but we can break it up. During writing, I don't know if y'all have seen this book ever before or if you know the lady who wrote it. So during the writing, you can break up the paper by the major sections. In our field, we have an introduction. We have usually a theoretical perspectives, methods, results, discussion, conclusion. You can break up those sections and give to individual people to write. You can even break it down by subsections, participants, instrumentation, statistical analyses, different smaller sections in the lit review, different theories that you want people to write about. Then you can assign them those tasks. Because if you ask someone to write, say, the lit review, I don't like lit reviews. I'm not going to write a lit review if I don't have to. For the most part, so I don't want to do that. But if you say, well, Tracy, can you write this theory? Just give me 2 paragraphs on this theory that we can put in. Yeah, I'll do that. That's cool. Okay, so you can break it up to fit the needs of your group. Dr. Goodson's book has tips and tricks on writing every single one of these major sections that you can then give to your teammates, too, and help them out. Because that might help them write it. It might be a little bit easier for them, or you can go through it in your team meetings. And I always try to allow people to choose what they write, because writing is a very personal thing. And usually if you assign a writing task, it's going to be a lot more difficult. We all, you know, have talked about, Maggie talked about that, when you don't want to write it and you have to, what do? I'd rather you want to write it. So let's try to help you out. And I know it doesn't happen all the time, but if it can happen most of the time, then that's good.
And even providing 2 options. Could you do this or this? Even if I don't really want to do A or B, having the option motivates me more than just being told to do one of them or the other.
What do you do? Some people write better than others. What do you do about different styles and the quality of the...
Well, and part of this is knowing your group and knowing what everyone's strengths are. So, for example, I know if I'm working with Tracy, she does not want to write the lit review, and that's just a fact of life. And so her lit reviews are not the strongest because that's not what she wants to do. She gets them done. They're very good. But ranking the sections of your writing. So part of that's knowing your group and knowing what people are going to be good at. And I mean, some people, you figure them out quickly, and some people it takes longer, but... When you're breaking up a writing project, you're not thinking, okay, we're going to break this up, paste it together, send it off. There's a lot of editing, and one of the jobs we always have in the revision steps is we need one person to go through and just make it sound like one person wrote this. That is a job. And there are some people will realize that they're good at that. We have one colleague who's very good at that, at making it sound like it was one person and one voice. But even if someone's a poor writer, they can do the first draft. They can get the ideas out. They can start the organizational piece. And once you have something, it's a lot, and we all know, the blank page is really scary. Having something, even something bad, is a lot better than having nothing.
And that leads right into the after writing. Make sure you leave plenty of time for editing, even longer. So if you want to submit this baby by September, I say make sure that you have all the pieces done and written by August or July is even better. And that way you have some extra time, and that's through the editing. But then you have some extra time because you're almost always going to use some of that extra time, and you don't want to be crunched up against this, especially if you've promised a team you're going to get a manuscript out by September. You don't want to be like, oh, actually, no, it's not going to happen in September. If you tell them September and you submit it in August, they're not mad at you. They're thrilled. So keep that in mind, too. But for the after writing process, choose one person, like Catherine said, to just go through for cohesiveness to make it sure it sounds like one person. I also always assign at least two people to edit globally and locally. So globally means for the overall organization, the argument, the quality, and locally is all the nitty-gritty stuff, the grammar, the citations. And again, I like global editing, not so good with local editing. I'm okay with a period being out of place or with, you know, little things, but I want the argument to sound really strong. So you need people on your team that can do both of those things and give it different eyes at different times there. Okay, so the other considerations, and Dr. Klupp brought this up earlier, but one of the things you should do from the start is discuss authorship. We have both been on projects and in situations where it has gotten sticky at the end, and you were like, but I thought that I was going to be on this paper, now I'm not on this paper. I thought I was going to have this authorship, and I'm not. So make sure everyone knows how much they're contributing and where they're going to be in authorship. Most professional organizations have some kind of guidelines for this you can use as a starting point. Our major organization does, and that's a great place to start for us. And every major field usually has this. But make sure people know, are they going to get authorship? So is there something in it for me, or I'm just your workhorse? People don't want to be the workhorse.
And this is especially important, and we all know this, if you're in any sort of position of power, even when we were working with the undergrads, because the undergrads are not going to start to question us. Well, one of them would. But but for the most part, they're not really going to question us, but then they're going to have these negative feelings. And we've worked with faculty who have not always been, and none of them are here, don't worry, who have not always been as straightforward, but as a graduate student, that puts me in a really awkward position. Like, what do I do about this? So I think it's so important to have these really explicit conversations right at the beginning about authorship, or really, as Dr. Klupp was saying, what am I going to get out of this? Make that clear.
And Jennifer asked, should it be in writing or should it be something not in writing? And that really kind of depends on knowing your group. There are people that I work with that I think I don't need to put it in writing because they're, you know, I trust them, they trust me. We're not going to, how do I say that politically? We're not going to be unfair to each other. That's the way you say that politically. It wasn't what was going through my head. But for some people, I know we got to put it in writing or else bad things are going to happen towards the end because they don't fully maybe, you know, trust authority, or I don't necessarily trust that they're going to get something done. So it just kind of depends on your group, but you want it to be something that's very mutual and amicable. Like if you have one person on the team do it, everyone has to have it in writing.
And you can do something as simple as if it evolves out of a natural conversation, just send an email later saying, like, just to recap, we talked about these things and this is what we agreed on for authorship, blah, blah, blah. We all save all of our emails now, so everyone will still have that. So it doesn't need to be a formal written contract. If you stick it in writing somewhere and you know it's there, you can always pull it up later.
We also recommend saving, like I said, plenty of time for writing tasks. Make sure it's longer than what you think.